potholes, its geography entrancing. Nor was it simply her sight that filled to brimming. The banister beneath her hand was more alluring than silk. The scent of sap and the taste of dust begged to be sniffed and savoured. Defying these distractions, she fixed her attention on the door ahead, holding her breath and removing her hand from the banister to minimise the sources of sensation. Even so, she was assailed. The creaks of the stairs were rich enough to be orchestrated. The shadows around the door had nuances to parade and called for her devotion. But she had a rod at her back, the commotion from below. It was getting louder all the time, and now, cutting through the shouts and roars, came the sound of Sartori's voice. "Where are you going, love?" he asked her. "You can't leave me. I won't let you. Look, love, look! I've brought the knives!" She didn't turn to see, but closed her eyes and stopped her ears with her hands, stumbling up the rest of the stairs, blind and deaf. Only when her toes were no longer stubbed and she knew she was at the top did she dare the sight again. The seductions began again, instantly. Every nick in every nail of the door said, "Stop and study me." The dust rising around her was a constellation she could have lost herself in forever. She pitched herself through it, with her gaze glued to the door handle, and clasped it so hard the discomfort cancelled the beguilings long enough for her to turn it and throw the door open. Behind her, Sartori was calling again, but this time his voice was slurred, as though he was distracted by profusion. In front of her was his mirror image, naked at the centre of the stones. He sat in the universal posture of the meditator, legs crossed, eyes closed, hands laid palms out in his lap to catch whatever blessings were bestowed. Though there was much in the room to call her attention, mantelpiece, window, boards and rafters, their sum of enticements, vast as it was, could not compete with the glory of human nakedness, and this nakedness that she'd loved and lain beside more than any other. Neither the blandishments of the walls, their stained plaster like a map of some unknown country, nor the persuasions of the crushed leaves of the sill could distract her now. Her senses were fixed on the reconciler, and she crossed the room to him in a few short strides, calling his name as she went. He didn't move. Wherever his mind wandered, it was too far from this place, or rather this place was too small a part of his arena, for him to be claimed by any voices here, however desperate. She halted at the edge of the circle. Though there was nothing to suggest that what lay inside was in flux, she'd seen the harm done to both Dowd and his voider when the bounds had been injudiciously breached. From down below she heard Celestine raise a cry of warning. There was no time for equivocation. What the circle would do, it would do, and she'd have to take the consequences. Steeling herself, she stepped over the perimeter. Instantly, the myriad discomforts that attended passage afflicted her, itches, pangs, and spasms, and for a moment she thought the circle intended to dispatch her across the Inovo. But the work it was about had overruled such functions, and the pains simply mounted and mounted, driving her to her knees in front of Gentle. Tears spilled from her knitted lids, and the ripest curses from her lips. The circle hadn't killed her, but another minute of its persecutions and it might. She had to be quick. She forced open her streaming eyes and set her gaze on Gentle. Shouts hadn't roused him, nor had curses, so she didn't waste her breath with more. Instead, she seized his shoulders and began to shake him. His muscles were lax, and he lolled in her grasp, but either her touch or the fact of her trespass in this charmed circle won a response. He gasped as though he'd been drawn up from some airless deep. Now she began to talk. "Gentle? Gentle! Open your eyes! Gentle! I said, open your fucking eyes!" She was causing him pain, she knew. The tempo and volume of his gasps increased, and his face, which had been beatifically placid, was knotted with frowns and grimaces. She liked the sight. He'd been so smug in his messianic mode. Now there had to be an end to that complacency, and if it hurt a little, it was his own damn fault for being too much his father's child. "Can you hear me?" she yelled at him. "You've got to stop the working. Gentle! You've got to stop it!" His eyes started to flicker open. "Good, good!" she said, talking at his face like a schoolmarm trying to coax a delinquent pupil. "You can do it! You can open your eyes! Go on! Do it! If you won't, I'll do it for you. I'm warning you." She was as good as her word, lifting her right hand to his left eye and thumbing back the lid. His eyeball was rolled back into its socket. Wherever he was, it was still a long way off, and she wasn't sure her body had the strength to resist its harrowment while she coaxed him home. Then, from the landing behind her, Sartori's voice. "It's too late, love," he said. "Can't you feel it? It's too late." She didn't need to look back at him. She could picture him well enough, with the knives in his hands and elegy on his face. Nor did she reply. She needed every last ounce of will and wit to stir the man in front of her. And then inspiration. Her hand went from his face to his groin, from his eyelid to his testicles. Surely there was enough of the old gentle left in the reconciler to value his manhood. The flesh of his scrotum was loose in the warmth of the room. His balls were heavy in her hand, heavy and vulnerable. She held them hard. "Open your eyes," she said, "or so help me, I'm going to hurt you." He remained impassive. She tightened her grip. "Wake up," she said. Still nothing. She squeezed harder, then twisted. "Wake up!" His breath quickened. She twisted again, and his eyes suddenly opened, his gasps becoming a yell which didn't stop until there was no breath left in his lungs to loose it on. As he inhaled, his arms rose to take hold of Jude at the neck. She lost her grip on his balls, but it didn't matter. He was awake and raging. He started to rise, and as he did so, pitched her out of the circle. She landed clumsily, but began harassing him before she'd even raised her head. "You've got to stop the working!"
"Crazy woman," he growled.
"I mean it! You've got to stop the working! It's all a plot!" She hauled herself up. "Dad was right, Gentle. It's got to be stopped."
"You're not going to spoil it now," he said. "You're too late."
"Find a way," she said. "There's got to be a way."
"If you come near me again, I'll kill you," he warned.
He scanned the circle to be certain it was still intact. It was.
"Where's Clem?" he yelled. "Clem?"
Only now did he look beyond Judith to the door, and beyond the door to the shadowy figure on the landing. His frown deepened into a scowl of revulsion, and she knew any hope of persuading him was lost. He saw conspiracy here.
"There, love," said Sartori. "Didn't I tell you it was too late?"
The two Gekagek fawned at his feet. The knives gleamed in his fists. This time he didn't offer the handle of either one. He'd come to take her life, if she refused to take her own.
"Dearest one," he said, "it's over."
He took a step and crossed the threshold.
"We can do it here," he said, looking down at her. "Where we were made. What better place?"
She didn't need to look back at Gentle to know he was hearing this. Was there some sliver of hope in that fact? Some persuasion that might drop from Sartori's lips and move Gentle where hers had failed?
"I'm going to have to do it for us both, love," he said. "You're too weak. You can't see clearly."
"I don't want to die," she said.
"You don't have any choice," he said. "It's either by the Father or the Son. That's all. Father or Son."
Behind her, she heard Gentle murmur two syllables.
"Oh, pie."
Then Sartori took a second step, out of the shadow into the candlelight. When he did, the obsessive scrutiny of the room fixed him in every wretched morsel. His eyes were wet with despair, his lips so dry they were dusty. His skull gleamed through his pallid skin, and his teeth in their array made a fatal smile. He was death in every detail, and if she recognized that fact, she who loved him, then so surely did Gentle. He took a third step toward her and raised the knives above his head. She didn't look away, but turned her face up towards him. daring him to spoil with his blades what he'd caressed with his fingers only minutes before.
"I would have died for you," he murmured.
The blades were at the top of their gleaming arc, ready to fall.
"Why wouldn't you die for me?"
He didn't wait for an answer, even if she'd had one to give, but let the knives descend. As they came for her eyes, she looked away, but before they caught her cheek and neck, the reconciler howled behind her, and the whole room shook. She was thrown from her knees, Sartori's blades missing her by inches. The candles on the mantelpiece guttered and went out, but there were other lights to take their place. The stones of the circle were flickering like tiny bonfires flattened by a high wind, flecks of their brightness racing from them to strike the walls. At the circle's edge stood Gentle, in his hand the reason for this turmoil. He'd picked up one of the stones, arming himself and breaking the circle in the same moment. He clearly knew the gravity of his deed. There was grief on his face, so profound it seemed to have incapacitated him. Having raised the stone, he was now motionless, as if his will to undo the working had already lost momentum. She got to her feet, though the room was shaking more violently than ever. The boards felt solid enough beneath her, but they darkened to near invisibility. She could see only the nails that kept them in place. The rest, despite the light from the stones, was pitch black, and as she started towards the circle, she seemed to be treading a void. There was a noise accompanying every tremor now, a mingling of tortured wood and cracking plaster, all underscored by a guttural boiling, the source of which she didn't comprehend until she reached the edge of the circle. The darkness beneath them was indeed a void, the inovo, opened by Gentle's breaking of the circle, and in it, already woken by Sartori's dabblings, the prisoners that connived and suppurated there, rising at the scent of escape. At the door, the Gekagek set up a clamour of anticipation, sensing the release of their fellows. But for all their power, they'd have few of the spoils in the coming massacre. There were forms appearing below that made them look kittenish, entities of such elaboration neither Jude's eyes nor wits could encompass them. The sight terrified her, but if this was the only way to halt the reconciliation, then so be it. History would repeat itself, and the maestro be twice damned. He'd seen the Oviats ascend as clearly as she, and was frozen by the sight. Determined to prevent him from re-establishing the status quo at all costs, she reached to snatch the stone from his hand, so as to pitch it through the window, but before her fingers could grasp it, he looked up at her. The anguish went from his face, and rage replaced it.
"Throw the stone away!" she yelled.
His eyes weren't on her, however. They were on a sight at her shoulder. Sartori. She threw herself aside as the knives came down and, clutching the mantelpiece, turned back to see the brothers face to face, one armed with blades, the other with the stone. Sartori's glance had gone to Jude as she leapt, and before he could return it to his enemy, Gentle brought the stone down with a two-handed blow, striking sparks from one of the blades as he dashed it from his brother's fingers. While the advantage was his, Gentle went after the second blade, but Sartori had it out of range before the stone could connect, so Gentle swung at the empty hand, the cracking of his brother's bones audible through the din of oviats and boards and cracking walls. Sartori made a pitiful yell and raised his fractured hand in front of his brother, as if to win remorse for the hurt. But as Gentle's eyes went to Sartori's broken hand, the other, whole and sharp, came at his flank. He glimpsed the blade and half-turned to avoid it, but it found his arm, opening it to the bone from wrist to elbow. He dropped the stone, a rain of blood coming after, and as his palm went up to stem the flow, Sartori entered the circle, slashing back and forth as he came. Defenseless, Gentle retreated before the blade and, arching back to avoid the cuts, lost his footing and went down beneath his attacker. One stab would have finished him there and then. But Sartori wanted intimacy. He straddled his brother's body and squatted down upon it, slashing at Gentle's arms as he attempted to ward off the coup de grace. Jude scoured the unsolid boards for the fallen knife, her gaze distracted by the malignant forms that were everywhere turning their faces to freedom. The blade, if she could find it, would be of no use against them, but it might still dispatch Sartori. He'd planned to take his own life with one of these knives. She could still turn it to such work if she could only find it. But before she could do so, she heard a sob from the circle, and glancing back, saw Gentle sprawled beneath his brother's weight, horrendously wounded, his chest sliced open, his jaw, cheeks, and temples slashed, his hands and arms crisscrossed with cuts. The sob wasn't his, but Sartori's. He'd raised the knife, and was uttering this last cry before he plunged the blade into his brother's heart. His grief was premature. As the knife came down, Gentle found the strength to thrash one final time, and instead of finding his heart, the blade entered his upper chest below his clavicle. Slickened, the handle slipped through Sartori's fingers. But he had no need to reclaim it. Gentle's rally was over as suddenly as it had begun. His body uncurled, its spasms ceased, and he lay still. Sartori rose from his seat on his brother's belly and looked down at the body for a time, then turned to survey the spectacle of the void. Though the Oviats were close to the surface now, he didn't hurry to act or retreat, but surveyed the whole panorama at the centre of which he stood, his eyes finally coming to rest on Jude.
"Oh, love," he said softly, "look what you've done. You've given me to my heavenly father."
Then he stooped and reached out of the circle to take hold of the stone that Gentle had removed, and, with the finesse of a painter laying down a final stroke, put it back in place. The status quo wasn't instantly restored. The forms below continued to rise, seething with frustration as they sensed that their route into the fifth had been sealed. The fire in the stone began to go out, but before their last gutterings, Sartori murmured an order to the Gekagek, and they sloped from their places at the door, their flat heads skimming the ground. Jude thought at first they were coming for her, but it was Gentle they'd been ordered to collect. They divided around the circle and reached over its perimeter, taking hold of the body almost tenderly, and lifting it out of their maestro's way. "Down the stairs," he told them, and they retreated to the door with their burden, leaving the circle in Sartori's sole possession. A terrible calm had descended. The last glimpses of the Inovo had disappeared. The light in the stones was all but gone. In the gathering darkness, she saw Sartori find his place at the centre of the circle and sit.
"Don't do this," she murmured to him.
He raised his head and made a little grunt, as though he was surprised she was still in the room.
"It's already done," he said. "All I have to do is hold the circle till midnight."
She heard a moan from below, as Clem saw what the Oviats had brought to the top of the stairs. Then came the thump, 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 as the body was thrown down the flight. There could only be seconds before they came back for her, seconds to coax him from the circle. She knew only one way, and if it failed, there could be no further appeal.
"I love you," she said.
It was too dark to see him, but she felt his eyes.
"I know," he said, without feeling, "but my heavenly father will love me more. It's in his hands now."
She heard the Oviats moving behind her, their breaths chilly on her neck.
"I don't ever want to see you again," Sartori said.
"Please call them off," she begged him,
remembering the way Clem had been apprehended by these beasts, his arms half swallowed.
"Leave of your own volition and they won't touch you," he said. "I am about my father's business."
"He doesn't love you."
"Leave."
"He's incapable."
"Leave."
She got to her feet. There was nothing left to say or do. As she turned her back on the circle, the Oviats pressed their cold flanks against her legs and kept her trapped between them until she reached the threshold, to be certain she made no last attempt on their summoner's life. Then she was allowed to go unescorted onto the landing. Clem was halfway up the stairs, bludgeon in hand, but she instructed him to stay where he was, fearful that the Gekagek would claw him to shreds if he climbed another step. The door to the meditation room slammed behind her, and she glanced back to confirm what she'd already guessed, that the Oviats had followed her out and were now standing guard at the threshold. Still nervous that they'd land some last blow, she crossed to the top of the flight as though she were walking on eggs, and only picked up her speed once she was on the stairs. There was light below, but the scene it illuminated was as grim as anything above. Gentle was lying at the bottom of the stairs, his head laid on Celestine's lap. The sheet she'd worn had fallen from her shoulders, and her breasts were bare, blooded where she'd held her son's face to her skin.
"Is he dead?"
Jude murmured to Clem. He shook his head.
"He's holding on."
She didn't have to ask what for. The front door was open, hanging half-demolished from its hinges, and through it she could hear the first stroke of midnight from a distant steeple.
"The circle's complete," she said.
"What circle?" Clem asked her. She didn't reply. What did it matter now? But Celestine had looked up from her meditation on Gentle's face, and the same question was in her eyes as on Clem's lips. So Jude answered them as plainly as she could.
"The Imagicus, a circle," she said.
"How do you know?"
Clem asked. "The goddesses told me."
She was almost at the bottom of the stairs, and now that she was closer to mother and son, she could see that Gentle was literally holding on to life, clutching at Celestine's arm and staring up into her face. Only when Jude sank down onto the bottom stair did Gentle's eyes go to her.
"I never knew," he said.
"I know,"
she replied, thinking he was speaking of Hapexamendius's plot.
"I didn't want to believe it either."
Gentle shook his head.
"I mean the circle," he said. "I never knew it was a circle."
"It was the goddess's secret," Jude said.
Now Celestine spoke, her voice as soft as the flames that lit her lips.
"Doesn't Hapexamendius know?"
Jude shook her head.
"So whatever fire he sends," Celestine murmured, "will burn its way around the circle."
Jude studied her face, knowing there was some profit in this knowledge, but too exhausted to make sense of it. Celestine looked down at Gentle's face.
"Child," she said.
"Yes, Mama."
"Go to him," she said. "Take your spirit into the first and find your father."
The effort of breathing seemed almost too much for Gentle, never mind a journey. But what his body was incapable of, maybe his spirit could achieve. He lifted his fingers towards his mother's face. She caught hold of them.
"What are you going to do?"
Gentle said.
"Call his fire," Celestine said.
Jude looked towards Clem to see if this exchange made any more sense to him than it did to her, but he looked completely perplexed. What was the use of inviting death when it was going to come anyway, and all too quickly?
"Delay him," Celestine was telling Gentle. "Go to him as a loving son, and hold his attention for as long as you can. Flatter him, tell him how much you want to see his face. Can you do that for me?"
"Of course, Mama."
"Good."
Content that her child would do as he was charged, Celestine laid Gentle's hand back upon his chest and slid her knees out from beneath his head, lowering it tenderly to the boards. She had one last instruction for him.
"When you go into the first, go through the dominions. He mustn't know that there's another way. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Mama."
"And when you get there, child, listen for the voice. It's in the ground. You'll hear it if you listen carefully. It says,
Nisi Nirvana."
"That's right."
"I remember," Gentle said. "Nisi Nirvana."
As if the name were a blessing and would protect him as he went on his way, he closed his eyes and took his leave. Celestine didn't indulge in sentiment, but rose, pulling the sheet up around her as she crossed to the bottom of the stairs.
"Now I have to speak to Sartori."
"That's going to be difficult," Jude said. "The door's locked and guarded."
"He's my son," Celestine replied, looking up the flight. "He'll open it for me."
And so saying, she ascended.
Chapter 24. 1. Gentle's spirit went from the house, thinking not of the father that awaited him in the first dominion, but of the mother he was leaving behind. In the hours since his return from the Tabula Rasa's tower,
They'd shared all too brief a time together. He'd knelt beside her bed for a few minutes while she told the story of Nisi Nirvana. He'd held on to her in the goddess's reign, ashamed of the desire he felt but unable to deny it. And finally, moments ago, he'd lain in her arms while the blood seeped out of him. Child, lover, cadaver. There was the arc of a little life there, and they'd have to be content with it. He didn't entirely comprehend her purpose in sending him from her, but he was too confounded to do anything but obey. She had her reasons, and he had to trust them, now that the work he'd laboured to achieve had soured. That, too, he didn't entirely comprehend. It had happened too fast. One moment he'd been so remote from his body he was almost ready to forget it entirely, the next he was back in the meditation room with Jude's grip earning his screams, and his brother mounting the stairs behind her, his knives gleaming. He'd known then, seeing death in his brother's face, why the mischief had torn itself to shreds in order to make him seek Sartori out. Their father was there in that face, in that despairing certainty, and had been all along, no doubt. But he'd never seen it. All he'd ever seen was his own beauty, twisted out of true, and told himself how fine it was to be heaven to his other's hell. What a mockery that was. He'd been his father's dupe, his agent, his fool, and he might never have realized it if Jude hadn't dragged him raw from the Anna and showed him in terrible particulars the destroyer in the mirror. But the recognition had come so late, and he was so ill-equipped to undo the damage he'd done. He could only hope that his mother understood better than he where the little hope left to them lay. In pursuit of it, he'd be her agent now, and go into the first to do whatever he could at her behest. He went the long way round, as she'd instructed, his path taking him back over the territories he'd travelled when he'd sought out the Synod, and though he longed to swoop out of the air and pass the time of a new day with the others, he knew he couldn't linger. He glimpsed them as he went, however, and saw that they'd survived the last hectic minutes in the Anna and were back in their dominions, beaming with their triumph. On the Mount of Lipabayak, Tik Raw was howling to the heavens like a lunatic, waking every sleeper in Vanief and stirring the guards in the watchtowers of Patashokwa. In the Quem, Skopeek was clambering up the slope of the pivot pit where he'd sat to do his part, tears of joy in his eyes as he turned them skyward. In his Orderix, Athanasius was on his knees in the street outside the Yohatemic Kesperate, bathing his hands in a spring that was leaping up at his wounded face like a dog that wanted to lick him well. And on the borders of the first, where Gentle's spirit slowed, Chikajakin was watching the erasure, waiting for the blank wall to dissolve and give him a glimpse of Hapexamendios's dominion. His gaze left the sight, however, when he felt Gentle's presence. "Maestro?" he said. More than any of the others, Gentle wanted to share something of what was afoot with Jakin, but he dared not. Any exchange this close to the erasure might be monitored by the god behind it, and he knew he'd not be able to converse with this man who'd shown him such devotion without offering some word of warning, so he didn't tempt himself. Instead, he commanded his spirit on, hearing Jakin call his name again as he went. But before the appeal could come a third time, he passed through the erasure and into the dominion beyond. In the blind moments before the first appeared, his mother's voice echoed in his head. "She went into a city of iniquities," he heard her saying, "where no ghost was holy and no flesh was whole." Then the erasure was behind him, and he was hovering on the perimeters of the city of God. No wonder his brother had been an architect, he thought. Here was enough inspiration for a nation of prodigies, a labour of ages, raised by a power for whom an age was the measure of a breath. Its majesty is spread in every direction but the one behind, the streets wider than the Patashokwan highway, and so straight they only disappeared at their vanishing point, the buildings so monumental the sky was barely visible between their eaves. But whatever suns or satellites hung in the heavens of this dominion, The city had no need of their illumination. Cords of light ran through the paving stones, and through the bricks and slabs of the great houses, the ubiquity ensuring that all but the most vapid shadows were banished from the streets and plazas. He moved slowly at first, expecting soon to encounter one of the city's inhabitants, but after passing over half a dozen intersections and finding no soul on the streets, he began to pick up his speed, slowing only when he glimpsed some sign of life behind the facades. He wasn't nimble enough to catch a face, nor was he so presumptuous as to enter uninvited, but he several times saw curtains moving, as though some shy but curious citizen was retiring from the sill before he could return the scrutiny. Nor was this the only sign of such presences. Carpets left hanging over balustrades still shook, as if their beaters had just retired from their patios. Vines dropped their leaves down as fruit gatherers fled for the safety of their rooms. It seemed that however fast he travelled, and he was moving faster than any vehicle, he couldn't overtake the rumour that drove the populace into hiding. They left nothing behind, no pet, no child, no scrap of litter, no stroke of graffiti. Each was a model citizen and kept his or her life out of sight, behind the drapes and the closed doors. Such emptiness in a metropolis so clearly built to teem might have seemed melancholy had it not been for the structures themselves, which were built of materials so diverse in texture and colour, and were lent such vitality by the light that ran in them that, even though they were deserted, the streets and plazas had a life of their own. The builders had banished grey and brown from their palette, and in its place had found slate, stone, paving, and tiles of every conceivable hue and nuance, mingling their colours with an audacity no architect of the fifth would have dared. Street after street presented a spectacle of glorious colour, facades of lilac and amber, colonnades of brilliant purples, squares laid out in ochre and blue. And everywhere, amid the riot, scarlet of eye-pricking intensity, and a white as perfect, and here and there, used more sparingly still, flicks and snippets of black, a tile, a brick, a seam in a slab. But even such beauty could pall, and after a thousand such streets had slipped by, all as heroically built, all as lushly coloured, the sheer excess of it became sickening, and Gentle was glad of the lightning that he saw erupt from one of the nearby streets, its brilliance sufficient to bleach the colour from the facades for a flickering time. In search of its source, he redirected himself and came into a square, at the centre of which stood a solitary figure, a Nullianak, its head thrown back as it unleashed its silent bolts into the barely glimpsed sky. Its power was many orders of magnitude greater than anything Gentle had witnessed from its like before. It, and presumably its brothers, had a piece of the god's power between the palms of its face, and its capacity for destruction was now stupendous. Sensing the approach of the wanderer, the creature left off its rehearsals and floated up from the square as it searched for this interloper. Gentle didn't know what harm it could do to him in his present condition. If the Nullianaks were now Hapexamendios's elite, who knew what authority they'd been lent? But there was no profit in retreat. If he didn't seek some direction, he might wander here forever and never find his father. The Nullianak was naked, but there was neither sensuality nor vulnerability in that state. Its flesh was almost as bright as its fire, its form without visible means of procreation or evacuation, without hair, without nipples, without navel. It turned and turned and turned again, looking for the entity whose nearness it sensed, but perhaps the new scale of its destructive powers had made it insensitive because it failed to find Gentle until his spirit hovered a few yards away.
"Are you looking for me?" he said.
It found him now. Arcs of energy played back and forth between the palms of its head, and out of their cracklings the creature's unmelodious voice emerged.
"Maestro," it said.
"You know who I am?"
"Of course," it said. "Of course."
Its head wove like that of a mesmerized snake as it drew closer to Gentle.
Why are you here? It said.
To see my father.
Ah.
I came here to honour him.
So do we all.
I'm sure. Can you take me to him?
He's everywhere, the Nullianak said. This is his city, and he's in its every moat.
So if I speak to the ground, I speak to him, do I? The Nullianak mused on this for a few moments.
Not the ground, it said. Don't speak to the ground.
Then what? The walls? The sky? You? Is my father in you? The arcs in the Nullianak's head grew more excitable.
No,
it said. I wouldn't presume. Then will you take me to where I can do him devotion? There isn't much time. It was this remark more than any other which gained the Nullianak's compliance. It nodded its death-laden head.
I'll take you, it said,
and rose a little higher, turning from gentle as it did so.
But as you say, we must be swift. His business cannot wait long.
2. Though Jude had been loath to let Celestine climb the stairs above, knowing as she did what lay at the top, she also knew that her presence would only spoil what little chance the woman had of gaining access to the meditation room, so she reluctantly stayed below, listening hard, as did they all, for some clue to what was transpiring in the shadows of the landing. The first sound they heard was the warning growls of the Gekagek, followed by Sartori's voice telling trespassers that their lives would be forfeit if they attempted to enter. Celestine answered him, but in a voice so low the sense of what she said was lost before it reached the bottom of the flight, and as the minutes passed, were they minutes? Perhaps only dreadful seconds, waiting for another eruption of violence, Jude could resist the temptation no longer, and, snuffing out the candles closest to her, started a slow ascent. She expected the angels to make some move to stop her, but they were too preoccupied with tending to Gentle's body, and she climbed unhindered by all but her caution. Celestine was still outside the door, she saw, but the Oviats were no longer blocking her way. At the instruction of the man inside, they'd shrunk away and were waiting, bellies to the ground, for a cue to do mischief. Jude was now almost halfway up the flight, and she was able to catch fragments of the exchange that was underway between mother and son. It was Sartori's voice she heard first. A wasted whisper.
It's over, Mama.
I know, child,
Celestine said. There was conciliation in her tone, not rebuke.
He's going to kill everything.
Yes, I know that, too.
I had to hold the circle for him. It's what he wanted.
And you had to do what he wanted. I understand that, child. Believe me, I do. I served him too, remember. It's no great crime.
At these words of forgiveness, the door of the meditation room clicked open and slowly swung wide. Jude was too far down the staircase to see more than the rafters, lit either by a candle or the halo of Oviat tissue that had attended on Sartori when he was out in the street. With the door open, his voice was much clearer.
"Will you come in?"
he asked Celestine.
"Do you want me to?"
"Yes, Mama. Please.
I'd like us to be together when the end comes."
A familiar sentiment, Jude thought. Apparently he didn't much care what breast he laid his sobbing head on, as long as he wasn't left to die alone. Celestine put up no further show of ambivalence, but accepted her child's invitation and stepped inside. The door didn't close, nor did the Gekagek creep back into place to block it. Celestine was quickly gone from sight, however. Jude was sorely tempted to continue her ascent and watch what unfolded inside, but she was afraid that any further advance would be sensed by the Oviats, so she gingerly sat down on the stairs, halfway between the maestro at the top and the body at the bottom. There she waited, listening to the silence of the house, of the street, of the world. In her mind she shaped a prayer.
"Goddess," she thought, "this is your sister Judith. There's a fire coming, goddess. It's almost upon me, and I'm afraid.
From above she heard Sartori speak, his voice now so low she could catch none of his words even with the door open. But she heard the tears that they became, and the sound broke her concentration. The thread of her prayer was lost. No matter. She'd said enough to summarize her feelings. The fire's almost upon me, goddess. I am afraid. What was there left to say? 3. The speed at which Gentle and the Nullianak travelled didn't diminish the scale of the city they were passing through. Quite the opposite. As the minutes passed and the streets continued to flicker by, thousand upon thousand, their buildings all raised from the same ripely coloured stone, all built to obscure the sky, all laid to the horizon, the magnitude of this labour began to seem not epic, but insane. However alluring its colours were, however satisfying its geometrics and exquisite its details, the city was the work of a collective madness, a compulsive vision that had refused to be placated until it had covered every inch of the dominion with monuments to its own relentlessness. Nor was there any sign of any life on any street, leading Gentle to a suspicion that he finally voiced, not as a statement, but as a question.
"Who lives here?"
he said.
"Hapex Amendios."
"And who else?"
"It's his city," the Nullianak said.
"Are there no citizens?"
"It's his city."
The answer was plain enough. The place was deserted. The shaking of vines and drapes that he'd seen when he'd first arrived had either been caused by his approach or, more likely, been a game of illusion the empty buildings had devised to while away the centuries. But at last, after travelling through innumerable streets that were indistinguishable from each other, there were finally subtle signs of change in the structures ahead. Their luscious colours were steadily deepening, the stone so drenched it must soon surely ooze and run, and there was a new elaboration in the facades, and a perfection in their proportions that made Gentle think that he and the Nullianak were approaching the first cause, the district of which the streets they'd passed through had been imitations diluted by repetition. Confirming his suspicion that the journey was nearing its end, Gentle's guide spoke.
"He knew you'd come," it said. "He sent some of my brothers to the perimeter to look for you."
"Are there many of you?"
"Many," the Nullianak said. "Minus one."
It looked in Gentle's direction.
"But you know this, of course. You killed him."
"He would have killed me if I hadn't."
"And wouldn't that have been a proud boast for our tribe," it said, "to have killed the Son of God?"
It made a laugh from its lightning, though there was more humour in a death rattle.
"Aren't you afraid?" Gentle asked it.
"Why should I be afraid?"
"Talking this way when my father may hear you."
"He needs my service," came the reply. "And I do not need to live."
It paused, then said,
"Though I would miss burning the dominions."
Now it was Gentle's turn to ask why.
"Because it's what I was born to do. I've lived too long waiting for this."
"How long?"
"Many thousands of years, maestro. Many, many thousands."
It silenced Gentle, to think that he was travelling beside an entity whose span was so much vaster than his own, and anticipated this imminent destruction as its life's reward. How far off was that prize, he wondered. His sense of time was impoverished without the tick of breath and heartbeat to aid it, and he had no clue as to whether he'd vacated his body in Gamut Street 2 minutes before, or 5, or 10. It was in truth academic. With the dominions reconciled, Hapex Amendios could choose his moment, and Gentle's only comfort was the continued presence of his guide, who would be, he suspected, gone from his side at the first call to arms. As the street ahead grew denser, the Nullianak's speed and height dropped, until they were hovering inches above the ground, The buildings around them grotesquely elaborate now, every fraction of their brick and stonework etched and carved and filigreed. There was no beauty in these intricacies, only obsession. Their surfeit was more morbid than lively, like the ceaseless, witless motion of maggots. And the same decadence had overcome the colours, the delicacy and profusion of which he'd so admired in the suburbs. Their nuances were gone. Every colour now competed with scarlet, the mingled show not brightening the air but bruising it. Nor was there light here in the same abundance as there'd been at the outskirts of the city. Though seams of brightness still flickered in the stone, the elaboration that surrounded them devoured their glow and left these depths dismal.
"I can go no farther than this, Reconciler," the Nullianak said. "From here you go alone."
"Shall I tell my father who found me?" Gentle said, hoping that the offer might coax a few more tidbits from the creature before he came into Habeximendios's presence.
"I have no name," the Nullianak replied. "I am my brother, and my brother is me."
"I see. That's a pity.
But you offered me a kindness, Reconciler. Let me offer you one."
"Yes?"
"Name me a place to destroy in your name, and I'll make it my business to do so. A city, a country, whatever."
"Why would I want that?" Gentle said.
"Because you're your father's son," came the reply. "And what your father wants, so will you."
Despite all his caution, Gentle couldn't help but give the destroyer a sour look.
"No," it said.
"No."
"Then we're both without gifts to give," it said, and turning its back, rose and went from Gentle without another word.
He didn't call after it for directions. There was only one way to go now, and that was on, into the heart of the metropolis, choked though it was by gourd and elaboration. He had the power to go at the speed of thought, of course, but he wished to do nothing that might alarm the unbeheld, so took his spirit into the garish gloom like a pedestrian, wandering between edifices so fraught with ornament they could not be far from collapse. As the splendours of the suburbs had given way to decadence, so decadence had in its turn given way to pathology, a state that drove his sensibilities beyond distaste or antipathy to the borders of panic. That mere excess might squeeze such anguish out of him was revelation in itself. When had he become so rarefied? He, the crass copyist, he, the sybarite who'd never said enough, much less too much. What had he become? A phantom aesthete driven to terror by the sight of his father's city. Of the architect himself there was no sign. And rather than advance into complete darkness, Gentle stopped and simply said, "Father?" Though his voice had very little authority here, it was loud in such utter silence, and must surely have gone to every threshold within the radius of a dozen streets. But if Habeximendios was in residence behind any of these doors, he made no reply. Gentle tried again.
"Father, I want to see you."
As he spoke, he peered down the shadowy street ahead, looking for some sign, however vestigial, of the unbeheld's whereabouts. There was no murmur, no motion, but his study was rewarded by the slow comprehension that his father, for all his apparent absence, was in fact here in front of him. And to his left, and to his right, and above his head, and beneath his feet. What were those gleaming folds at the windows if they weren't skin? What were those arches if they weren't bone? What was this scarlet pavement and this light-shot stone if it wasn't flesh? There was pith and marrow here. There was tooth and lash and nail. The Nullianak hadn't been speaking of spirit when it had said that Habeximendios was everywhere in this metropolis. This was the city of God, and God was the city. Twice in his life he'd had presentiments of this revelation. The first time when he'd entered his Orderex, which had been commonly called a city god itself, and had been, he now understood, his brother's unwitting attempt to recreate his father's masterwork. The second, when he'd undertaken the business of similitudes, and had realized, as the net of his ambition encompassed London, that there was no part of it, from sewer to dome, that was not somehow analogous to his anatomy. Here was that theory proved. The knowledge didn't strengthen him, but instead fueled the dread he felt, thinking of his father's immensity. He'd crossed a continent and more to get here, and there'd been no part of it that was not made as these streets were made, his father's substance replicated in unimaginable quantities to become the raw materials for the masons and carpenters and hod carriers of his will. And yet, for all its magnitude, what was his city? A trap of corporeality, and its architect its prisoner.
"Oh, father," he said,
and perhaps because the formality had gone from his voice, and there was sorrow in it, he was finally granted a reply.
"You've done well for me," the voice said.
Gentle remembered its monotony well. Here was the same barely discernible modulation he'd first heard as he stood in the shadow of the pivot.
"You've succeeded where all the others failed,"
Hapexamendios said.
"They went astray, or let themselves be crucified. But you, reconciler, you held to your course."
"For your sake, father."
"And that service has earned you a place here," the god said. "In my city, in my heart."
"Thank you," Gentle replied, fearful that this gift was going to mark the end of the exchange. If so, he'd have failed as his mother's agent. "Tell him you want to see his face," she'd said. "Distract him, flatter him." Ah, yes, flattery. "I want to learn from you now, father," he said. "I want to be able to carry your wisdom back into the fifth with me."
"You've done all you need to do, reconciler,"
Hapexamendios said.
"You won't need to go back into the fifth, for your sake or mine. You'll stay with me and watch my work."
"What work is that?"
"You know what work,"
came the god's reply.
"I heard you speak with an Ulyanak. Why are you pretending ignorance?"
The inflections in his voice were too subtle to be interpreted. Was there genuine inquiry in the question, or a fury at his son's deceit? "I didn't wish to presume, father," Gentle said, cursing himself for this gaffe. "I thought you'd want to tell me yourself."
"Why would I tell you what you already know?"
the god said, unwilling to be persuaded from this argument until he had a convincing answer.
"You already have every knowledge you need."
"Not everyone," Gentle said, seeing now how he might divert the flow.
"What do you lack?"
Hapexamendios said.
"I'll tell you everything."
"Your face, father."
"My face? What about my face?"
"That's what I lack. The sight of your face."
"You've seen my city,"
the unbeheld replied.
"That's my face."
"There's no other?"
"Really, father? None?" "Aren't you content with that?"
Hapexamendios said.
"Isn't it perfect enough? Doesn't it shine?"
"Too much, father. It's too glorious."
"How can a thing be too glorious?"
"Part of me is human, father. And that part's weak. I look at this city and I'm agog. It's a masterwork."
"Yes, it is."
"Genius."
"Yes, it is."
"But, father, grant me a simpler sight. Show a glimpse of the face that made my face, so that I can know the part of me that's you." He heard something very like a sigh in the air around him.
"It may seem ridiculous to you," Gentle said, "but I followed this course because I wanted to see one face. One loving face."
There was enough truth in this to lend his words real passion. There was indeed a face he'd hoped to find at the end of his journey.
"Is it too much to ask?" he said.
There was a flutter of movement in the dingy arena ahead, and Gentle stared into the murk in the expectation of some colossal door opening. But instead, Hepeximendios said,
"Turn your back, reconciler."
"You want me to leave?"
"No. Only avert your eyes."
Here was a paradox. To be told to look away when sight was requested. But there was something other than an unveiling afoot. For the first time since entering the Dominion, he heard sounds other than a voice. A delicate rustling, a muted patter, creaks and whirrings stealing on his ear. And all around him, tiny motions in the solid street as the monoliths softened and inclined towards the mystery he'd turned his back upon. A step gaped and oozed marrow. A wall opened where stone met stone, and a scarlet deeper than any he'd seen, a scarlet turned almost black, ran in rills as the slabs yielded up their geometry, lending themselves to the unbeheld's purpose. Teeth came down from an unknitted balcony above, and loops of gut unravelled from the sills, dragging down curtains of tissue as they came. As the deconstruction escalated, he dared the look he'd been forbidden. Glancing back to see the entire street in gross or petty motion, forms fracturing, forms congealing, forms drooping and rising. There was nothing recognisable in the turmoil, and Gentle was about to turn away when one of the pliant walls tumbled in the flux, and for a heartbeat, no more, he glimpsed a figure behind it. The moment was long enough to know the face he saw, and have it in his mind's eye when he looked away. There was no face its equal in the Imagica. For all the sorrow on it, for all its wounds, it was exquisite. Pi was alive and waiting there, in his father's midst, a prisoner of the prisoner. It was all Gentle could do not to turn there and then and pitch his spirit into the tumult, demanding that his father give the mischief up. This was his teacher, he'd say, his renewer, his perfect friend. But he fought the desire, knowing such an attempt would end in calamity, and instead turned away again, doting on the glimpse he'd had while the street behind him continued to convulse. Though the mischief's body had been marked by the hurts it had suffered, it was more whole than Gentle had dared hope. Perhaps it had drawn strength from the land on which Hepeximendios's city was built, the Dominion its people had worked their fates upon before God had come to raise this metropolis. But how should he persuade his father to give the mischief up? With pleas? With further flattery? As he chewed on the problem, the ructions around him began to subside, and he heard Hepeximendios speak behind him.
"Reconciler?"
"Yes, father."
"You wanted to see my face?"
"Yes, father."
"Turn and look."
He did so.
The street in front of him had not lost all semblance of a thoroughfare. The buildings still stood, their doors and windows visible, but their architect had claimed from their substance sufficient pieces of the body he'd once owned to recreate it for Gentle's edification. The father was human, of course, and had perhaps been no larger than his son in his first incarnation, but he'd remade himself three times Gentle's height and more. A teetering giant that was as much borne up by the street he'd racked for matter as of it. For all his scale, however, his form was ineptly made, as if he'd forgotten what it was like to be whole. His head was enormous, the shards of a thousand skulls claimed from the buildings to construct it, but so mismatched that the mind it was meant to shield was visible between the pieces, pulsing and flickering. One of his arms was vast, yet ended in a hand scarcely larger than Gentle's, while the other was wizened but finished with fingers that had three dozen joints. His torso was another mass of misalliances, his innards cavorting in a cage of half a thousand ribs, his huge heart beating against a breastbone too weak to contain it and already fractured, and below, at his groin, the strangest deformation. A sex he'd failed to conjure into a single organ, but which hung in rags, raw and useless.
"Now," the god said, "do you see?"
The impassivity had gone from his voice, its monotony replaced by an assembly of voices, as many larynxes, none of them whole, laboured to produce each word.
"Do you see?" he said again. "The resemblance?"
Gentle stared at the abomination before him, and, for all its patchworks and disunions, knew that he did. It wasn't in the limbs, this likeness, or in the torso, or in the sex, but it was there. When the vast head was raised, he saw his face in the ruin that clung to his father's skull, a reflection of a reflection of a reflection, perhaps, and all in cracked mirrors, but oh, it was there. The sight distressed him beyond measure, not because he saw the kinship, but because their roles seemed suddenly reversed. Despite its size, it was a child he saw, its head fetal, its limbs untutored. It was eons old, but unable to slough off the fact of flesh, while he, for all his naivetes, had made his peace with that disposal.
"Have you seen enough, reconciler?"
Apexamendios said.
"Not quite."
"What, then?"
Gentle knew he had to speak now, before the likeness was undone again and the walls were resealed.
"I want what's in you, father."
"In me?"
"Your prisoner, father. I want your prisoner."
"I have no prisoner."
"I'm your son," Gentle said.
"The flesh of your flesh. Why do you lie to me?" The unwieldy head shuddered. The heart beat hard against the broken bone.
"Is there something you don't want me to know?" Gentle said, starting towards the wretched body. "You told me I could know everything."
The hands, great and small, twitched and jittered. "Everything, you said, because I've done you perfect service.
But there's something you don't want me to know."
"There's nothing."
"Then let me see the mischief. Let me see Pi Opa."
At this, the god's body shook, and so did the walls around it. There were eruptions of light from beneath the flawed mosaic of his skull, little raging thoughts that cremated the air between the folds of his brain. The sight was a reminder to Gentle that, however frail this figure looked, it was the tiniest part of Hepexamendios's true scale. He was a city the size of a world, and if the power that had raised that city and sustained the bright blood in its stone was ever allowed to turn to destruction, it would beggar the Nullianax. Gentle's advance, which had so far been steady, was now halted. Though he was a spirit here and had thought no barrier could be raised against him, there was one before him now, thickening the air. Despite it, and the dread he felt when reminded of his father's powers, he didn't retreat. He knew that if he did so, the exchange would be over, and Hepexamendios would be about his final business, his prisoner unreleased.
"Where's the pure, obedient son I had?"
the god said.
"Still here," Gentle replied. "Still wanting to serve you, if you'll deal with me honourably."
A series of more livid bursts erupted in the distended skull. This time, however, they broke from its dome and rose into the dark air above the god's head. There were images in these